This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
For this Wednesday, May 20th, we welcome you to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. With the coronavirus pandemic continuing to impact the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today formally triggering a rules change allowing proxy voting on the floor in upcoming debates. This is significant, marking the first time in its 230-year history that the House will allow such a procedure to be used. And by the way, the House returns next week. The Pentagon has issued new guidance for local commanders in states where stay-at-home orders are beginning to relax. Since late March, all military installations globally have been in a partial lockdown after the Defense Department raising the global health protection level to its second highest setting. Worldwide, we are approaching nearly 5 million cases of coronavirus, more than 320,000 deaths across the globe, and the World Health Organization reporting that in the largest single-day increase of coronavirus in the last 24 hours, another 106,000 cases. We'll have the latest on COVID-19 and the story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill with today's Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senate Republicans issuing their first subpoena as part of a wide-ranging investigation tied to the Obama administration and former Vice President Joe Biden. In this election year, it further deepens the political battle in Congress between the two parties. It was a party-line vote seeking records from Blue Star Strategies. That is a firm with ties to that Ukrainian gas company where Hunter Biden served on the board until last year. Of course, former Vice President Joe Biden is the likely Democratic presidential nominee. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, is the committee chair.
The other business item we'll be conducting here is the motion to subpoena Blue Star. The subpoena to Blue Star Strategies for documents January 1st, 2013, to present related to work for Burisma or those associated with Burisma. Also for the attendance of CEO Karen Tramontano for a deposition regarding that work and the attendance of COO Sally Painter for deposition regarding that work. That's what we're here to meet today and to vote on. And with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Peters.
That announcement from Senator Ron Johnson, of course, today's action bringing a quick and angry response from Senate Democrats. Michigan Senator Gary Peters had this reaction at today's hearing.
Well, as is obvious to all of us, we're in the middle of an unprecedented public health and economic emergency. More than 90,000 Americans have died during this pandemic, and nearly 36 million Americans are currently out of work. This committee has a longstanding, nonpartisan tradition of oversight of our nation's disaster response and safeguarding our homeland security, and I believe that should always be our top priority. We should be working together to hold oversight hearings on the pandemic response efforts with the administration. We should be working together to reassure worried families that the federal government is capable of moving us towards reopening safely. And at this moment, when Americans need us to work together, this extremely partisan investigation is pulling us apart. We are all here today in close proximity with each other and our staffs in close proximity to each other, in the middle of an ongoing crisis that has already cost far too many American lives and cost Americans more jobs than the Great Recession. To cast a single vote on a partisan subpoena to obtain some documents from 4 years ago, documents that are already being substantially provided to the committee, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, at this point, to enter into the record a letter from Blue Star Strategies received, and I'll just quote one paragraph here. At every opportunity, we have indicated to the committee that it is our intention to cooperate. At no time have we ever stated or indicated in any way that we would not cooperate. Therefore, we are puzzled, despite our willingness to cooperate, why the committee is proceeding to vote on this subpoena. Without objection, if I can enter into the record.
Without objection, it will be entered in the record, but I will refute what they're saying in that letter. But without objection, it will be entered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a serious bipartisan investigation in the tradition of this committee, and I believe we should not be going down this dangerous road.
That from earlier today, and we covered the committee hearing. It's available on our website at cspan.org. In a written statement, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had this response. Nearly 100,000 Americans have died from coronavirus, and yet the GOP Senate is wasting precious time and taxpayer dollars smearing the president's political rivals while telling hungry families and laid-off workers to just take a pause. Well, now to the State Department, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo held a press conference that TheHill.com describes as, quote, testy and combative. He again tried to fend off questions about his call to fire the State Department's internal watchdog, the Inspector General, while also criticizing Democrats, saying that this move is political retaliation. And the Secretary of State defended the president's authority to fire the IG, Steve Linnick. He did so late Friday, saying it should have been done some time ago. Here is what it sounded like at the State Department.
Several Senate Republicans say they want a specific explanation as to why the administration fired the inspector general here. Senator Grassley says an expression of lost confidence without further explanation is not sufficient to fulfill the requirements of the IG Reform Act. Will you provide Congress a more detailed explanation on why you recommended the firing to the president? And will the State Department make the House Foreign Affairs Committee deadline for documents this Friday at 5?
So there's been lots of discussion about this. I've read a number of reports. Let me say three things. First, the president has the unilateral right to choose who he wants to be his inspector general at every agency in the federal government. They are presidentially confirmed positions, and those persons, just like all of us, serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States. In this case, I recommended to the President that Steve Linnick be terminated. I frankly should have done it some time ago.
I think I got to get you out, sir.
I'm happy to take one more.
Okay, Barbara, go ahead.
Okay, so you have said, sir, that Mr. Linnick was undermining the department's mission. What exactly does that mean? Can you give us examples? Even the president doesn't know what that means. He says he didn't really know about the guy before you mentioned it. So what specifically has Mr. Linnick done?
Yeah, unlike others, I don't talk about personnel matters. I don't leak to y'all.
And, so did he?
Yeah, I'll just say this. I can't talk. I can't give you specificity. We'll share with the appropriate people the rationale, but no, there should be no mistake.
He's the accountability official. Is it a secret as to why he was fired?
May I answer the question, if you will? I appreciate the question. Let's be clear. There are claims that this was for retaliation, for some investigation that the inspector general's office here was engaged in. It's patently false. I have no sense of what investigations were taking place inside the inspector general's office. Couldn't possibly have retaliated for all the things. I've seen the various stories that someone was walking my dog to sell arms to my dry cleaner. I mean, it's all just crazy. It's all crazy stuff.
So
I didn't have access to that information, so I couldn't possibly have retaliated. It would have been impossible. There's one exception. I was asked a series of questions in writing. I responded to those questions with respect to a particular investigation that was sometime earlier this year, as best I can recall. Responded to those questions. I don't know the scope. I don't know the nature of that investigation other than what I would have seen from the nature of the questions that I was presented. I did what was right. I don't know if that investigation is continuing. I don't know if that investigation has been closed out. I don't have any sense of that. Again, it's not possible that further have been retaliation. Here's the last thing to think about as you see these stories that have been leaked to you all, right, to the press. This is all coming through the office of Senator Menendez. I don't get my ethics guidance from a man who was criminally prosecuted. Case number 15-155 New Jersey Federal District Court, a man for whom his Senate colleagues bipartisan said basically that he was taking bribes. That's not someone who I look to for ethics guidance, and so I'll continue to do the right thing to make sure the State Department is served by every employee, including our attorney inspector general, and we'll make sure the State Department continues to deliver on behalf of the American people.
Congressman Engel, what about the House Foreign Affairs Committee?
Thank you all. Everybody have a great day and a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, too. So long.
Can we ask a question about the Saudi arms emergency declaration?
That from the State Department earlier today, and the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, making reference to Senator Bob Menendez, who was charged with bribery. He was later acquitted. There is another investigation from NBC News investigating what we called the Madison Dinners. The Secretary of State apparently holding about two dozen of these dinners since he took office in 2018 that were light on diplomatic guests and heavy on corporate invitees. Pompeo's elite taxpayer-funded dinners raising new concerns. The full story available online at NBCNews.com. Meanwhile, Michigan's attorney general saying that the president has a, quote, legal responsibility under state law to wear a mask as a coronavirus precaution when he visits a Ford Motor plant tomorrow. In an open letter to the president, who so far has refused to wear facial coverings, the state attorney general saying, quote, I ask that while you are on tour, you respect the great efforts of the men and women at Ford and across this state by wearing a facial covering. The components plant in Ypsilanti, Michigan, does have a policy requiring masks at its plant, and Ford saying it informed the White House of this requirement. Again, the president traveling to Michigan tomorrow. At a news conference here in Washington, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi comparing the president to a child with, quote, doggy do on his shoes. It is the latest back and forth between the two as they exchange insults that often turn personal. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
Given what you just said about the president and his administration, how are you confident that you are going to be able to come together? The two of you have been exchanging pretty strong criticism in the last few days. How does that help negotiating another deal?
Well, I didn't say anything about the president. I gave him a dose of his own medicine. He's called women one thing or another over time. And I thought he thinks that passes off as humor in certain cultures. And I thought that was what that was. And I was only quoting what doctors had said about him. So I was being factual in a very sympathetic way. I said, he's our president. We don't want our president taking something that could be dangerous, as the scientists have said it could be. If he takes offense at that, well, I could take offense at a lot of things, but they don't really mean that much to me. But again, a dose of his own medicine.
Just earlier this week, the speaker referring to the president as, quote, morbidly obese. It brought this response yesterday by President Trump.
These people are sick. Pelosi is a sick woman. She's got a lot of problems, a lot of mental problems. We're dealing with people that have to get their act together for the good of the country. Okay, thank you very much.
And this is the headline at thehill.com. Speaker Pelosi, President Trump slide further into the muck. Joining us on the phone is congressional reporter Mike Lillis. And as you point out, this really does come at a delicate moment in negotiations on what's next for coronavirus and any congressional stimulus.
That's right, Steve. You know, there's no love lost between Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi. That is not new. It comes as no surprise to anybody who's been following their relationship over the years. And especially since impeachment last December. But even considering all of that, the recent flare-up has been remarkable for a couple reasons. One of them is it's been highly personal. And the second one, more importantly, more significantly, is the thing you just mentioned. It's coming during this coronavirus when, you know, $3 trillion is already out the door. They're trying to figure out if it's going into the right places. They're trying to figure out if it's working to help small businesses, unemployed workers, medical workers, you know, all the things that you're hearing about. And yet you've got the president of the United States and the speaker of the House of Representatives who literally will not talk to each other and are on public television making these very personal attacks. So, you know, it's a very strange debate. And it's also coming at a time when they're talking about trillions more dollars. So it's not just the $3 trillion out the door. The House, of course, Pelosi last week had already passed $3 trillion on top of the first $3 trillion. So, I mean, you're talking about a lot of money. This is all requires federal cooperation. It requires cooperation between the parties. But it also requires, levels of oversight to make sure that the programs are operating correctly. And a lot is at stake because the economy has tanked in a way that it hasn't since the Great Depression. And of course, we're in an election year. So a lot of different considerations here, but it is quite a remarkable debate. And again, really flaring up this week in a personal way.
And just going over the last couple of months, last October, when the speaker walked out of a White House meeting focused on Syria, and then, of course, more recently, the two were at a prayer breakfast, and clearly you could tell by the body language there was no love lost between the speaker and the president. But if you look at history, we have reelected four of our last five presidents. So if the president is in office in 2021, and so is the speaker, how do the two get beyond this?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. And I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody knows the answer. I think important to note that even despite this feud, despite them not talking directly, they have been able to pass four, you know, very significant response bills, relief bills, emergency aid bills to the coronavirus, $3 trillion. And the White House has done so by sending Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, up to negotiate on behalf of the president. And he has a good working relationship, obviously, with the Republican leaders, with Mitch McConnell and McCarthy, but also with Pelosi and with Charles Schumer, with the Democratic leader in the Senate. So essentially, Trump is doing it by proxy. You know, he's never been a stickler for policy anyways. You know, he likes to claim the victory, but has never really cared too much about the details. So he sends Mnuchin up. They can negotiate the big picture stuff. They can get things passed. They have done that in the past over government spending bills. They're doing it now over coronavirus relief. And if next year Trump were still president, Pelosi were still speaker, and they hadn't mended fences for whatever reason, I think you could anticipate more of the same. You know, in other words, Trump would still send Mnuchin or whoever the emissary is, if Mnuchin is no longer there, if there's a new cabinet member or something like that, or whatever the issue is. Trump does not have to be in the room to negotiate everything. And that's not new. You know, there have been a lot of feuds between congressional leaders and presidents of opposing parties. You know, famously, Mitch McConnell and President Obama did not get along on a personal level. To the point that Obama would frequently send his vice president, Joe Biden, to the Capitol to break some of these stalemates over government funding. You know, remember, you know, being in the Capitol at midnight on New Year's Eve one year with McConnell and Joe Biden hashing out a government spending bill to prevent a New Year's Eve shutdown. So, you know, the personal animosities are not new necessarily. But, you know, these are people who find ways around them and at the end of the day seem to understand the necessity of getting at least the big picture stuff done. And you know, a lot of it's political posturing, especially in an election year. So hopefully they would get over it and move on to, you know, kind of mend those fences next year. But again, if not, there are ways around.
We're talking with Mike Lillis of The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. But one final point, because as you pointed out, there's been a long history of differences between the president of one party and the speaker of another. But this really has become personal, where the speaker is talking about the president's weight, the president referring to Nancy Pelosi as Nervous Nancy.
That's right. Yeah, I'm trying to think back of another time when it became so personal. You know, it's one thing to attack somebody's you know, their policies or some program that goes wrong, but this is really on a whole new level, and it's not something that I can remember, at least in the recent past. And so obviously they both have long memories. They both hold a grudge. I don't think anybody doubts that. So you know, it's a very prickly situation, and it's going to be very hard to get over it, to get over the hurdle of getting them back in the same room if they wanted to do something like infrastructure, for example, which is something that they both said that they wanted to do last year. They were both sitting down at the same table trying to get something big done. Those negotiations fell apart, and that was kind of the beginning of the end of the relationship. As it stands right now, if you remember that, there was a big flare up and Trump stormed into the room during one of the infrastructure talks and slammed his hands on the desk and said, I can't negotiate with you guys anymore. And shortly after that, impeachment started, and that was sort of the end of it. So yes, you're right. It's extremely personal, and no one knows how this ends. But at least for the short term, it's not going to end well.
The growing feud between the president and the Speaker of the House, Mike Lillis. It's available at thehill.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. Anytime.
Today, Connecticut becoming the final state to begin easing coronavirus lockdown restrictions, allowing a number of businesses to open for the first time in more than 2 months, but doing so with restrictions. For example, restaurants may only allow dining in the outdoor areas. Bars that don't serve food must remain closed until June 20th. Offices, retail stores, and malls are now permitted to reopen at 50% capacity with strict cleaning protocols. Face coverings are also required in many public situations. Gyms, theaters, nail salons, spas, they'll remain closed until at some point next month. And in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo declaring the state is undergoing an important transition as it begins to reopen economic activity across the state while seeking to curtail the COVID-19 spread. The governor also announcing that religious ceremonies can resume across the state beginning tomorrow, although scaled down and with new restrictions. More from Albany.
We're working with religious institutions. Right now, they can have up to 10 people with strict social distancing guidelines at religious gatherings. We've asked them to consider drive-in and parking lot services for religious ceremonies. But we're going to be working with our Interfaith Advisory Council. Our Interfaith Advisory Council has representatives of the religious community across the state, all different religions. I understand their desire to get back to religious ceremonies as soon as possible. As a former altar boy, I get it. I think it, even at this time of stress and when people are so anxious and so confused, I think those religious ceremonies can be very comforting. But we need to find out how to do it and do it safely and do it smartly. The last thing we want to do is have a religious ceremony that winds up having more people infected. Religious ceremony, by definition, is a gathering, right? It's a large number of people coming together. We know from New Rochelle, Westchester, the first hotspot, that religious ceremonies can be very dangerous. So we all want to do the same thing. The question is, how do we do it? And how do we do it smartly and efficiently? And I'll be talking with members of the religious community in doing just that. And I'm sure that we can come up with a way that does it, but does it intelligently.
That from Governor Andrew Cuomo. Of course, New York leading the country in death toll and the U.S. leading the world. So far, more than 91,000 Americans have succumbed as a result of the virus. And one of those victims, Wilson Roosevelt German. He served as a White House butler for more than 5 decades. He died from COVID-19. He first began working at the White House as a housekeeper under the Eisenhower administration back in 1957. And then 4 years later, in 1961, President Kennedy promoting him to a White House butler. And he stayed through the years, serving Presidents Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, Obama, and the administrations of both Presidents Bush. Wilson German was 91 years old. At WashingtonPost.com, this headline, as the backlogged IRS struggles to open mail and answer the phone, taxpayers facing some long delays. If you've not yet received a refund check or are still waiting for that stimulus, personnel issues are part of the reason. Lisa Ryan covers the federal government for The Washington Post, and we talked to her late this afternoon.
So every federal agency, you know, has really struggled in the pandemic with, you know, its workforce teleworking or on paid leave. But the IRS in particular has really had its plate fuller than most because of the stimulus package that Congress passed. And the IRS was a key part of that, right? So they have had to distribute 150 million stimulus checks right, you know, during the pandemic when about half of their workforce has been sidelined at home. Plus, this all came in the middle of refund season. So they had to pretty much close down operations on March 30th. That's what the administrator did because he was obviously worried that, you know, he couldn't have public-facing employees who were at risk of getting the virus, contracting the virus, and they have a lot of cubicle farms across the government, you know, where these customer service employees work, as well as, you know, as you said, you know, so many of the IRS's processes, you know, for dealing with amended returns or, you know, appeals of enforcement actions or audits. I mean, you know, paper refunds. I mean, so many of these things are paper-based and really, you know, require, you know, the employees to actually interact with taxpayers through the mail. So it's really been kind of a mammoth backlog that they faced and just a huge stressor for them.
And of course, it's no secret, we have covered the hearings, that the IRS is facing a lot of technology challenges, really not quite yet in the 21st century in many areas.
That's right. So they really have, you know, what has been described to me as the oldest technology in the government. I mean, they have their sort of mainframe computer system uses, you know, a software called COBOL, which, you know, programmers from the 1970s and 80s will recall. And it's kind of this big joke at the IRS how when they have technology experts who retire, how it's just very hard for them to hire new people who actually know this programming language. So, you know, but so there's that. And then there's also just, you know, the fact that they have really struggled with massive budget cuts in the last, I'm going to say, 8 or 9 years as a Republican Congress, you know, looked unkindly on them for a variety of scandals. And remember the Tea Party, the active Tea Party really took a dislike to the IRS and some of its processes. And so they've lost about 20% of their staff in recent years, as well as big budget cuts. And those include, you know, cuts to funding that would help them modernize their technology. So what they're sort of left with is just running in place, where most of their tech budget goes to just, you know, keeping maintaining the old systems. And those systems are really not that great, you know, in terms of interacting with taxpayers.
We're talking with Lisa Ryan of The Washington Post. We have a lot of federal employees who listen to this program, as well as those contract workers. Is there a plan to basically return these employees, dealing with either telework issues, childcare schedules, and of course here in Washington, D.C., the Metro?
Right. So here's what happened. On April 27th, they said to the employees, okay, 10 service centers, and the D.C. area was not among those, but they decided to try to get volunteers to come back, about 11,000 was their goal, to these service centers across the country. And what happened was, you know, they said, okay, well we're going to clean, you know, the offices regularly. We're going to give you gloves and masks, and we're going to put you in every other cubicle instead of every cubicle. We're going to give you hand washing breaks. But only about 3,000 have come back. So actually yesterday, Commissioner Rettig sent another update to all of the 76,000 employees saying, look, this volunteer effort did not really work. So now what we're doing is we're actually telling employees in three states that they must, with a forced recall for employees in three states. Now, none of these are in our area, in the D.C. area, but they are Texas, Utah, and Kansas, if I'm right. And so what they're, and these are states where there were shelter in place orders that have very recently been lifted. And so that what they're saying to those employees is, look, if you have underlying health conditions, you can self-certify and not come back to work, you know, and stay on paid leave. But they're not really helping out with childcare issues, which you know, in the summer is a particularly a big issue for employees. Now, in our area in D.C., I don't think this is really the bulk of employees here, but they're not so far, I mean, as of today, they're not invoking that order to bring people back. And I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, just what you mentioned, which is, you know, the Metro is, for all intents and purposes, not really an option for many federal employees. And a lot of, you know, IRS employees work in the downtown headquarters here. They work in New Carrollton. You know, they work in other areas in Maryland and Virginia. So for now, I think those employees who cannot telework will still be on paid leave. But, you know, this agency is you know, it's massive and it goes across the country. So there'll be big changes for a lot of people in the coming weeks.
And our listeners can get more information at WashingtonPost.com. Lisa Rhine, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Wall Street, the markets were up across the board, the Dow gaining nearly 570 points, the NASDAQ rose 190, and the S&P up 48.5. On his Twitter account this morning, the president with the following, quote, breaking, Michigan sends absentee ballots to 7.7 million people ahead of the primaries and the general election. This was done illegally, writes the president, and without authorization by a rogue secretary of state. I will ask to hold up funding to Michigan if they want to go down this voter fraud path. But it turns out to be a false claim. Michigan's Secretary of State sent out applications for anyone who might be interested in an absentee ballot, not a ballot itself. And in fact, with the Democrats yet to formally nominate Joe Biden and the Republicans the president, general election ballots won't be printed until the fall. At today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany responding to this question from John Roberts of Fox News.
John.
Kayleigh, what does the president believe is illegal about the Secretary of State of Michigan sending out absentee ballot applications, and what federal funding is he considering withholding from the state of Michigan as a result?
So, you know, I won't get into exactly what the funding considerations are. I would note that his tweets were meant to alert Secretary Mnuchin and Mr. Vogt about, head of OMB, about his concerns with trillions of dollars going to these states and his noted concerns about a lot of fraud that is potentially at play when you have mass mail-in voting. So with regard to the illegality and legality of it, that's a question for the campaign as to their voting and ballot practices. But I would just note that his tweet was meant to alert OMB. He wanted to be very careful as we send trillions of dollars to states that we keep this important point in mind and we ensure that there's fairness in our voting system and absolute accuracy.
But the president himself has voted just 2 months ago by a mail-in ballot. There are several Republican states that are also doing these mail-in applications for ballots. And so I'm confused. What is it that he thinks is illegal that's happening in Michigan? He doesn't really specify.
So first, with regard to the president doing a mail-in vote, the president is, after all, the president, which means he's here in Washington. He's unable to cast his vote down in Florida, his state of residence. So for him, that's why he had to do a mail-in vote. But he supports mail-in voting for a reason. When you have a reason that you are unable to be present, there's right now, we're very far from November 3rd. I'm glad that you have the prediction tool and you can tell us what will be happening on November 3rd, 2020. I certainly don't, nor does the president.
Primary's coming up, and that's like what's happening in Nevada.
I assume you care about fairness and accuracy in our elections. Do you not?
Of course, not evidence that there is widespread voter fraud.
There's evidence. You can go look this up on ProPublica. There is a bipartisan consensus on the fact that mass mail-in voting can lead to fraud. There was a 2005 commission by none other than President Carter, who's not a member of the Republican Party, and also James Baker about this, concluding that these ballots, quote, remain the largest source of potential voter fraud. So this is a concern. The president's right to look at this. We want a free and fair election, and that's his concern.
From today's White House briefing, by the way, a number of states already have mail-in ballots, most notably Oregon. On SiriusXM yesterday, Senator Jeff Merkley explaining how it works in his state.
It's incredible. We've been doing it since the year 2000. After you fill out your ballot, you sign the back of it. Your signature is compared to your signature on file. If anyone says it doesn't look familiar enough or similar enough, because after all, people's signatures can change over decades. Mm-hmm. You get a call to come and confirm that it was indeed your ballot. We've had essentially no scandals. Probably the worst thing that happens occasionally is somebody who's moving votes in one state, and then maybe there's a later primary in Oregon. Our primary is actually tonight. Mm-hmm. So maybe they moved and they voted in primary in March in one state and May in Oregon, but that's hardly a fraud of the type we're talking about. That's
right.
Somebody's mistake. And so it's a very, very reliable, good system, and it makes sure that people don't get disenfranchised because of traffic, because of snow, because someone rigged the precinct to have too few poll workers or because the computers went down there that night. It's all paper, so it can be recounted, which is a huge factor in legitimacy. Sure. There's no hanging chad, so you don't have to worry about Florida problem. Right. There's people of both parties watching ballots at every step. They're all locked up. It's really a great system. One of those valuable things, which has become more and more important, is it stops so many forms of voter suppression and voter intimidation. Mm-hmm. The Republicans are trying to stop poor people from voting. They're trying to stop college students from voting, people of color from voting, Indian tribes from voting. And they, you know, so many different ways you can attempt to make it hard. Well, this says, you know what, you can't do all those tricks. You can't understaff it. You can't create a four-hour wait in line.
Right.
You can't move the polling place at the last second and get away with that. That's why I'm really pushing for a guaranteed absentee ballot, no excuse, this November across the country.
That defense of mail-in voting from Senator Jeff Merkley, he appeared on SiriusXM yesterday during an interview. And this morning on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, we asked Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan, who, by the way, is a Republican, about the president's tweet. The president again threatening to withhold federal aid to Michigan while falsely claiming that the Secretary of State in Michigan sent out absentee ballots this week. Instead, he sent out applications for an absentee ballot. Here's Congressman Upton.
Let me just say this. We want people to participate in elections. Michigan has had a no reason to get an absentee ballot for some time now, particularly if you're over 50 or 55 years old. That changed a vote by the people in the last election, no reason for absentee ballots. But yesterday in Oregon, I want to say we had the primary there. I think 100% of the folks that voted in the state of Oregon voted by absentee ballot, by mail. So this is going to be new for us. Traditionally, we always have our polls open, our primaries in August, the general, of course, in November. I don't know whether we'll still have polls open, but they're going to, apparently, our clerk or our state decided that they're going to send an application to every voter in the state for them to fill it out and return it back for an absentee ballot. You know, I don't know if it's going to get tested in the court. This is going to be new, but I also know that as a democracy, we want everyone to participate. And there are areas in the country that have done all mail ballots. And, you know, that may be happening here. We had a municipal election in the city of Portage, I know, just a couple of weeks ago. I don't live there, but I don't know what the vote percentage was. But they did it totally by absentee ballot as well.
And that this morning on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, Republican Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan and Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel, who's also from Michigan, told reporters earlier this week that she doesn't have a problem with absentee applications being sent out to voters as long as measures are kept to verify that only registered voters get those proper ballots. A reminder, this program is available as a podcast. You can find it wherever you get your favorite podcast, or better yet, go to our website at cspan.org/podcasts. For this Wednesday, May 20th edition of Washington Today, I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Enjoy the rest of your evening. On C-SPAN's The Weekly, as the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden is in the process of selecting his running mate. We know it will be a woman. The question remains, who? We talked to former Vice President Walter Mondale, who is the last Democratic nominee back in 1984 to select a female running mate, then Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. He is also credited with redefining the role of the vice presidency during his 4 years in the Carter administration.
I think that I helped talk Carter into it, but I think Carter was half persuaded to do it when we started talking, because he knew that the vice presidency had been a totally underused and wasted office.
Former vice president and 1984 Democratic presidential nominee Walter Mondale. On C-SPAN's The Weekly. It's available at cspan.org/podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @CSPAN Radio.